Hello and welcome to First 7-Inch Club episode 51. First 7-Inch Club is a podcast where we dig up a 7-inch by a forgotten or obscure band within the realms of hardcore punk and metal and discuss whether or not they're worth being remembered. We'll also provide factoids and trivia that we gleaned from the internet and our own personal experiences. Although we don't personally consider ourselves know-it-alls or experts, many other people do. We tend to get things wrong here and there, but hey, what can you do? We're only human. I am Mike, and with me is Scott.
Mike, we got a sizzling piece of Border Boss classic content today. I'm flattered to report that I'm not gonna name them yet because the actual content is forthcoming. So we'll do a full Border Boss episode in a month or two when this actually happens. But a listener and a friend is getting married at the Taco Bell Las Vegas Wedding Chapel.
Oh my God!
And not only that, but he invited me.
Oh my God! And,
I'm not gonna go. Because all of air travel is in free fall right now. Yeah. Like everything's a mess. There's still COVID going on, and COVID is very irritating to me. So I'm not looking to sit next to some asshole. And I'm also a parent, so I don't get to do anything fun like that anymore. But yeah, I'm very flattered that I was invited to this. But yeah, he's going to. And I looked it up. I looked up the wedding chapel, and you get swag. You get to use the chapel, which looks very scenic. Like it's very cool looking. For a Taco Bell, it is a Taco Bell. It just has a couple of beautiful things added to it. And you get a taco reception area stocked with, eats and drinks for 25 people. And they give you a one-of-a-kind bouquet made of hot sauce packets. So she gets to throw like 30 hot sauce packets at her ladies-in-waiting or whatever you're the bridesmaids or whatever you call them. So that's in the works. He says he's going to give us a scene report, when that all lays out. Number two, Brian, thrift store jobber, all the different names he goes by, dropped two cool things in the Discord just the last couple days. He put a Garfield puzzle where Garfield has a Ramones record in the background and, also has a Garfield hat. Like he has a hat of himself hanging, in his bedroom.
There's also a single cum sock hanging out.
There's a cum sock. Yep.
Yeah.
It's very cool. You can find it for somebody must have caught onto it because it's a little bit more expensive than other Garfield puzzles on eBay, but you can still find it. It's pretty nice. It looks authentic because if you zoom in, the Ramones have been drawn by a Garfieldish type artist. I don't know if it's by Jim Davis or some also ran, but someone actually redrew a Ramones cover Garfield style. So you can have that. And he also gave us a video of. So I guess he found a T-shirt of a country jamboree from the year 2000, and Weird Al is listed as one of the acts. And he found a video of that happening, and it is amazing because it is it's some dirt rally, it's some bullshit dirt rally. He's making fun of it. He's calling it like the hillbilly Woodstock or something like that, or the redneck Woodstock. But he puts on a full set and he goes for it. It's all of his hits, bunch of polka songs, all kinds of shit. Dozens of costume changes for the whole band, the whole nine yards, and between songs he's being booed, which I just didn't think it was possible. You don't picture Weird Al, and he's giving it. He's like really putting on the show. He's not flagging one bit. He's doing crazy high kicks that I didn't think a grown man could do, and he's booed for most of the set.
Yeah,
and we discussed goofy metal in the past, but do you have any background in goofy music? Did you, when you were a little kid, did you listen to any goofy shit?
I liked Weird Al. I mean, I was the exact right age when Fat came out. That was like, my mind was blown. I didn't even think that was possible to do that. Yeah. Outside of that, not really. I think I was too young for Dr. Demento.
Yeah.
And I like novelty rap, but I don't think that really counts because it wasn't like, I don't think I was just listening to it because it was a novelty, but like, the Rappin' Duke, the John Wayne rap, the Honeymooners rap.
Yep.
Honeymooners rap was definitely, I thought I knew that was funny. So
yeah.
So yeah, I guess novelty rap, and I still have like an affinity for it. Every time I hear one of those songs, I'm just like, yeah, I'm into this.
Oh, I was desperate to somehow get like Rappin' Rodney.
Yep.
And the Ronald Reagan rap that was out there. I wanted all those things so bad. Like, I didn't know how to get them because I was like a child or something when those were happening. And they'd play in the radio once in a while and I'd run to find a cassette somewhere. And that's the way it was for all that stuff. I liked all that. I liked Fish Heads. I like all those goofy songs when I was a kid. I loved them. That's what I wanted to listen to. I wanted to listen to, there's a song called Dead Puppies. That was one of my favorite songs. I listened to it over and over. But getting them in some listenable format, I had no idea how to do it. I still wouldn't. I mean, you can just Google it now and get whatever you want. Yeah. But if I just went to a record store, where would I go to find Dead Puppies or one of those kind of goofy songs, like, or the Star Trek and song or the Doctor Who song or something like that? Where do you find, where would I have found one song?
like sometimes that? They have a humor. Sometimes they have a humor section. Yeah. Sometimes they'll have like a celebrity section. A lot of that shit, like Rap and Rodney and all that shit, is basically 12-inch singles. So it's usually just mixed in with all the other 12-inch rap singles that no one really looks at.
Yeah. Did you ever, and this is like a very dumb question because I'm sure of the answer, but did you ever fall for any of the sort of like Adult Swimmy nerdcore shit when that was early starting and some of it almost seemed like real music?
No. Like, I think there was an attempt with MC Chris where people were like, no, he's really good. And it's like, it was like, no, he's not really good. I can't remember what it was, but I remember there was a podcast I used to listen to that like really pushed the shit out of that stuff too. And I was just like, I don't get it, man. Like, this sucks. Like, I guess it's good for those types of people, those nerdcore people, but I never got into it myself.
I couldn't keep track of when the stuff was real and when it was nerdcore stuff, because like when Major Lazer came out and he was like all over Adult Swim, I still don't know if that's real music or not. So I've never been able to sort any of it out. I don't listen to any of it. It used to make me really angry. I used to read some web comics where they'd try and put links to MC Chris and who's the other guy? The original, like the guy with glasses, MC Frontalot, or whatever, all that shit. And I hated it. I really, really hated it. And everybody around me was into it. And that's my first taste of what it felt like to be in the real life surrounded by people from the internet. It was horrific. One last thing. This won't matter to almost anybody other than locals. Somebody posted a flyer for the old record store in Cohoes called Essential Sounds. And the reason I bring this up is because there was a story about Essential Sounds that I always heard about. So it's basically a guy's basement, and he sold skateboards and he sold hardcore albums. And people of my age talk about this thing like it was some legendary secret, like legendary spot to get everything you ever wanted, and that you were lucky to get, you know, to have known this place. Essential Sounds is literally a basement. Like, you went into a neighborhood and you went into a guy's house and you went into his basement, and he stood there and looked at you while you looked at his records. And he was this tall, skinny guy with like wiry, long gray hair and a giant Luigi mustache. And he had a really weird, almost like a Boston accent, but like a Muppet Boston accent. And he pronounced I only went there 3 times, but he compared everything to Grimlock and he compared everything else to Coalesce, which he pronounced Coalesce. Coalesce. They sound a lot like Coalesce, is what he would say to me. And I'm like, that can't be. All these bands can't sound like Grimlock and Coalesce. That was sort of his thing. And it was a weird place to be, and it was a weird place to shop. Other people had a better time. But I had always heard that he had that place because he had like a kid that was into skating and hardcore, and he wanted to like connect with that kid. So he started the store as a way to like bond with that child. Well, that child posted a comment under that flyer, and that is not the story. That is not how it went. She apparently, it was a girl. First of all, I would have thought it was a boy, you know, just you hear that it's like that. Yep. He's trying to bond with this skateboarding kid. No, it's a daughter, and she dated, you know, the guy from One King Down or whatever, and was super into hardcore. So what happened was he saw that, you know, she was buying all this stuff, and there was a lot of merch for hardcore and punk back then. She was buying all this stuff, and he was like, oh, I can make money off that. And he started a store, and apparently he was not a particularly cool dad. And, you know, she posted a little bit more than she maybe wanted to post in that thread or whatever. But yeah, the whole thing fell apart. For me, it was this good-natured thing. He's this goofy dad who wanted to, like, you know, bond with his son. Nope. Every part of that was wrong.
it was all money. It's always the money.
This podcast is killing everything for me.
Yeah. Couple Taco Bell things of my own. First, thanks everybody for alerting me that the potato thing, the Taco Bell not having potatoes, is a singular problem. It's my problem. It's my
exclusive to you.
Yeah, it's exclusively just my local Taco Bell. It's not even the Taco Bell a half mile away from that Taco Bell. It's just the one single Taco Bell near my house. I just checked a little while ago. They're still out of potatoes.
The potato truck doesn't go that far.
I don't know if they're like, listen, if we're going to make this fucking Mexican pizza, we cannot handle potatoes also. I don't care what all the other places are doing. It's just not happening for us. I don't know. It's a weird thing. It sucks. Honestly, maybe they just fucked up their menu and they forgot to put that they're selling potatoes. I don't know. Maybe I might have to do an investigative report. I may have to go undercover to the Taco Bell.
Yeah,
and order a taco in real life and talk to them. I'm gonna put on a mustache so they don't know it's me. They don't know it's Mike from First 7-Inch Club, aka Border Boss. Yeah. And so they don't know that they're it's gonna be an expose. So
yeah,
and I'll be like, hey man, what's up with the potatoes? So we'll see, but. I forgot there one other thing in Taco Bell news before that I forgot to mention. I am in another room right now. It is a room filled with city sounds. Mm-hmm. You might hear trains going by, you might hear loud motorcycles, you might hear all that shit. So
they say the neon lights yeah. are bright.
So if you hear you might hear people complaining at the Taco Bell that there are no potatoes, because that's where we're right over there right now. So
you'll hear a crowd, where are the damn potatoes?
Yeah, so I apologize if it's noisier than usual. Even though there seems to be background noise that's impossible to get rid of on my end at all yeah. times for some reason. Speaking of which, I was on Cinepunks. They could not get rid of my background noise at all. It was kind of embarrassing, honestly. But it's on there if you want to listen to Cinepunks.
Yeah.
Me talk about some movies that I love a lot. So yeah. it's up there. Go to their website. Speaking of that, I wasn't going to bring it up, but speaking of that Las Vegas Cantina Taco Bell, I randomly put on this show yesterday, actually, called Players, and I think it's a streaming only show. I think it's on Paramount Plus. Mm-hmm. And it's a mockumentary about a League of Legends team, which is like an esports thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm always a sucker for that shit. I have not really much of a clue what League of Legends is, but I get it.
Yeah.
So I watched it, and it turns out it's a much better show than I was expecting. It's pretty funny. It's they don't like usually if they make something like that for such a niche kind of hobby or something, they dumb it down a lot. This doesn't seem dumbed down at all. It seems like if you don't know the terms, they don't give a shit. They're not going to hold your hand, and mm-hmm. and I appreciate that, even though I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. But
yeah.
but I like it. But no, there's an episode where they go in depth about the Las Vegas Taco Bell Cantina, and it's. Yeah, so it's pretty coincidental, and they show they give a little tour of it really quick, and it's definitely not my cantina, that's for sure. It's pretty amazing. So it's, maybe your friend saw that and said, "Hey,
dude, everybody does a better job at Border Boss than Border Boss."
Yeah, so now I want to go to that Las Vegas cantina, but yeah. Oh, so check out Players if you guys are into that stuff. I think it's on Paramount Plus. It's on one of those channels. You'll get it. But the only other thing I had was that I went to a show. It was by a band called The Strokes. I don't know if anybody has mm-hmm. heard of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to a show. I don't go that often, so I guess I could talk about it. I don't really know much about the band The Strokes, to the point where I might have told the story on some form of this podcast before, but one of the first times I hung out with Scott outside of band stuff. It was also with his friend Tristan, who recently stabbed him in the back
yeah.
and joined a dead guy cover band with Jake yep. Bannon.
Yep.
But we were at the Palais Royale, and four guys walked in dressed in tight pants and like leather coats or something. Mm-hmm. And Scott said, "Hey, look, it's the Strokes." And I was like, "Oh, cool." Because like I had no idea who the Strokes were. I was just like, "Oh, I guess that's a local Albany band, the Strokes." And you know, after a while, I think he told me or somebody, it was like, no, it's not really the Strokes. They're like a famous band.
Yeah.
And that's about as much as I've ever known about the Strokes.
Yeah, time elapsed. I didn't realize that I had fooled you.
Yeah. And so like 20 years later, I have a couple friends that work for the Strokes. So mm-hmm. One of them was like, "Hey, you want to go see the Strokes?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." $200 ticket. I didn't pay for
holy
that.
I
was on the guest list. This is a fundraiser for a politician. $200 ticket. I've been on a lot of guest lists. I don't really go to many shows if I'm not on a guest list.
Yeah.
Never this expensive
wow.
guest list.
That's value.
I don't think I've ever hit the $200 point. That's a fucking lot. And I've probably come close, but yeah, $200 a lot. But it wasn't like, see, again, I don't really know the Strokes, so I think maybe it's like it's cool because it's this venue called the Metro, which is like kind of a legendary venue in Chicago. It's not very big. It's like the Webster Hall of Chicago, basically, I would call it. So it's not super huge, but it's not super tiny. You're not going to be some DIY punk band is not going to play there. But when they did that like crazy Knocked Loose Harm's Way show at like midnight, I think that was at the Metro. But usually it's a little classier bands. But it's not like arena bands. And I assume Strokes is kind of an arena band at this point. I don't know. Or maybe they were at some point. But so I assume a little of the appeal is seeing the Strokes in like a semi-smaller venue. But, you know, when I saw that and it was a fundraiser, I was going there and it was a fundraiser for a politician. So I was going there expecting like a scene from Batman, like everybody just in like tuxedos, like a bunch of elderly people in tuxedos eating hors d'oeuvres and the Strokes playing and me being the only person there in a t-shirt and everybody else wearing tuxedos and evening gowns. But no, it was just a bunch of young, wealthy people in shorts and shirts, like they're about to go to Nantucket or the beach or something. And I was very shocked because I don't know, man. I don't know much about the Strokes band, so I don't know what would get me to pay $200 to see a band.
Not much.
yeah. And I'll say one incentive was that there was no opening bands. I would pay $20 extra for that privilege to just
that's true.
Get rid of the opening bands. It's perfect. Not $200 extra though, but so yeah, I don't know. I think I recognized about 1.5 songs. I definitely recognized their last song in their encore, and that was the hit. And I think I recognized one other song from maybe a video game from like Guitar Hero or something, but nothing else like rang a bell with me. But I'm on the guest. You're on the guest list, so you get like balcony passes, and usually in most cases when this happens to me, it usually means like you're roped off from the riffraff and you could just fucking lounge around and stretch out. But I don't know if you could pay for that option here or they just had a lot of guest list passes on the show, because the balcony was just as packed as every other part of the place. So it's fucking super duper no vacancy, sold out. Yep. So I just pulled up a chair all the way in the back and because I had no desire to see this band. I just wanted to hang out with my friends. So I just pulled a chair in the back and just try to mind my business, and people still bother me. But
just
you know,
blowing a $200 seat.
yeah, pretty much. I mean, it wasn't like there were seats up there. I just found a chair and I was like, I'm gonna go sit here. I can't see shit anyways. It was hot. I have no desire. What are these people gonna do to me? I could have definitely pushed my way to the front if I wanted to, but I have no desire. These
you would
people
have outweighed actually, most of the people there.
Yeah, if you're actually paying money, I'm not going to ruin anybody's time. I'm just there to hang out with my friends. But yeah, so I sat there and I had a lot of contemplating to do while I was there because I had nothing else to do. And I noticed, like, it kind of made sense to me when we were talking last week. If you guys didn't tune in last week, we talked about new bands and, you know, some new bands and their sounds and basically like bands like Anxious and Koyo, who are kind of on the wimpier side of things. And I kind of was like, I don't know why this still exists. I assumed it would go away with my generation, but it still exists. And watching the Strokes and watching people like rhythmlessly dance to it, it made sense because there's just like a level of whiteness I will never attain. Mm-hmm. I'll never understand. I'm just way beyond that point. I've never been in that social class. It's too late for me. I think it's too late for me to marry into that social class. So I'm just stuck. I'll always be an outsider when it comes to that stuff. So I'm watching these people thinking about it, and I'm just like, I think I get it now, because you like the Anxious and stuff like that. I think you have to be a certain level of whiteness for that too, but you don't want to go to the dark side yet. You don't want to be on the Strokes yet.
Right.
You want to still be a little punk, but you definitely want to be white, because that is a privilege and it's great to be white, but you don't want to be too white, so you have to settle on something like Anxious. So I get it now, guys. I get it while you're into that music, and I get why I'm not. But at the same time, you're just going to end up at that Stroke show just like I was, and you're going to love it.
I wonder how many of the people who are in sort of the lesser versions of this are also private school kids, like the Stroke, like most of the bands from New York City, like the 2000 New York City garage rock boom and all that shit. Were like scions of industry. They were like extremely well-off children of very like moneyed industrial people and stuff like that, and who were like all private school kids and shit. So I wonder if that's still part of the part of the package.
I'm sure it is. But you know, they started a little late, very unprofessional for $200. But outside of that, pretty cut and dry show. Cheapest beer was $9 and it was cash only. Like, Who the fuck is carrying around $9 American post pandemic? Like credit cards, man. Like, what the fuck? So I didn't even get drunk. This was the first show I've been fully sober for since I've probably become of age. Because it's just like, the fuck am I gonna do? paying $9 for a fucking. I'm not gonna go to an ATM with a $4 charge to pay $9 for a fucking Heineken. So I sat there sober, just watching people dance weird. But it was fun. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, other Ryan. I don't think either of you guys listen to this, but you know, just in case, it was a fun time. It's a experience I would otherwise never see, because I, like I said, I am not that part of the whiteness. But yeah, that's about it. That's about all I had. I guess I should plug First 7-Inch Club at Instagram, First 7-Inch Club on YouTube, and First 7-Inch Club at gmail.com if you want to reach us out to us a little privately.
Yeah.
If you want to give us some recommendations or requests or whatever, just hit us up on Instagram or whatever, and we'll take care of that.
Yeah, not one single person has responded to my, you know, off night for a wild front man question. Nobody responds to any of my shit. Start responding or I'm done. If I don't start getting people replying to my little like whimsical queries at the beginning of the show, I'm fucking done with this shit, man. I need some feedback here.
Yeah, we need some feedback, guys. We're
I'm lonely.
We're running on fumes here. You got to give us some feedback. Oh, Taco Bell though got a lot of feedback for that. So
yeah,
I guess it just depends. So tonight we're talking about a band called The Dedication and their 7-inch Youth Murder Anthems from 2000. Oh shit, it's 2002. I know it's 2001. I put 2001.
Yeah.
On the YouTube already. Everybody's gonna make fun of me, but
shit.
Allegedly 2002. The Dedication Youth Murder Anthems on Death Wish. Death Wish release number 4. Dedication was a band from Boston. This was a request by Sawyer, who also requested I Hate You. Sawyer 2 for 2 for picking bands that were hugely popular at the time that really only had like a little bit of music and that I couldn't think of because I'm a dumb idiot and
yeah,
I started the podcast and wanted to do stuff like this and just couldn't think of any but Sawyer did it. The Dedication really only put out this record and they put out a demo. Maybe they have some comp tracks or something, some odds and ends here and there, but that's pretty much it. One of the things that about the 7-inch that I don't think I realized, because I had the 7-inch back in the day and I liked it very much, but I don't think I ever realized that this 7-inch was actually just part of an EP, part of a 6-song EP on CD, because I was, by 2002, by 2002, I definitely don't think I was buying CDs anymore, and if I was, it was very scarce, and if there was a 7-inch, I'd rather buy the 7-inch, so, so this band had 6 songs altogether, and plus their demo, but we only heard 3 on the 7-inch, so we're going to pretend those other 3 don't exist for...
Bullshit, doesn't count.
For this but yeah, that was it. After this they quickly broke up. I think they were only really around for maybe 2001 to 2002. That was about it. And then a couple of guys went to do a band called Sex Positions that was probably equally as popular and also about equally abruptly broke up.
Yeah.
And then that was about it for them. But right now we're going to be talking about The Dedication, not that other shit. But yeah, like I said, I had this record back in the day. I liked it a lot. This came out around that whole, even though this wasn't on Bridge 9, it came out around that whole Bridge 9 boom of people taking like more traditional hardcore and making it like more emotional and epic and stuff like that. And these guys, even though they didn't really sound like that, they got kind of lumped into that whole thing. I think some of these guys were in bands like that, and they were just from Boston, and that's where all these bands were from Boston. So
yeah,
they got lumped in. So they had like a lot, I think they had a lot of crossover appeal with several different types of people, including me, because I wasn't really down for that outside of American Nightmare. But this is one of the only other bands outside of that scene I liked. I did some light doxing on these guys. I didn't do very heavy doxing, but I'm sure Scott can fill in the blanks if he has any. So I'm just going to go over member by member. Mike Kilfoyle was the bassist. Outside of this, he was in another youth crew hardcore band called Make It Last. They only had a 7-inch, so they did not last. So that was a false advertising. All I can find out about present day Mike is he's listed as doing consulting, which is a fake job. I don't think that's a real job.
Yeah.
that's you're probably in the mob or something. You're saying doing consulting. That's not a real thing. Larry Unzoni is the drummer. He was one of the guys who later would join Sex Positions. This guy was the most surprising to me because as we'll get into the music, he's a very busy drummer. And usually when you hear a very busy drummer, if he's not in 10,000 bands, you assume he attained either the level of being a drum teacher or at least in like a weird prog rock band. But as far as I know, he did a couple other bands where he played guitar, Wicked Sea of Lions and the Burned Bridges.
Yep.
And, I don't think he's done anything outside of drums besides Sex Positions, unless, like I said, I couldn't really find anything current day outside of those two other bands. So maybe he is a drum teacher now, but For such a busy drummer, seems very weird to leave the drums behind at an early age. But Eric Marcelino played guitar. He was another guy who joined Sex Positions. Oh no, I'm sorry. He did production on the Sex Positions. I think he was a studio engineer for them. I don't think he did any other bands after this or anything notable that I wrote down. His Instagram says he runs an ad agency now and he's a music producer. Also says entrepreneur though, major red flag. Yeah. I looked through his Instagram though. He didn't seem too douchey. I think maybe he's the rare good entrepreneur. I don't know, but it didn't seem like he was by scrolling through his Instagram. It didn't seem like he was ready to jump back into the hardcore scene, but it also looked like if you talked about it to him, he wouldn't shy away from it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's in his, I think it's in his rare view right now, though. Sean Kilfoyle, I would assume, is Mike's brother. He played guitar also. He was also in Make It Last. He was in something called Blonde Acid Cult that I didn't check it out. More recently, he did a solo project called Minx. He also changed his name to Sonny, so he's Sonny and yep. Sonny Kilfoyle now. And I guess Minx sounds like a Cure influence pop music. I didn't listen to it. Again, that's about it for that guy that I looked up. Richard Peruzzi is the singer. He was in Sex Positions also. He played drums for Stop and Think, which was another big kind of Bridge Nine era band. And he played guitar in a band called Hypocrite. And I did not find anything. I think Hypocrite was a newer band. Like, I think they're within the last few years. So I think he's still part of the scene. But outside of that, I didn't like find out his career or anything. So I think he's still lingering around the hardcore scene, or at least he was a couple years ago. But that's about it that I did for them.
I got a lot for you then.
Okay.
I did all the between the cracks work. Okay. Some of it's pretty interesting. So both the Kilfoyles were in Blonde Acid Cult, who, like, that band name, right? You listen to that band name, you're like, oh, that's going to be something. They sound like the Soup Dragons. They sound like something that, like, the Trainspotting characters would listen to, like, when they're not listening to techno or something like that. And I think that that's on purpose. There's some write-up that says, like, they channeled the hard rock, blah, 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 and also the Madchester scene of the 90s. I'm like, wow, those, wow. Okay. The drummer, Larry, he is still doing music, and he teaches music. This guy works with coffee. He works with a distillery. He teaches music. He plays in a band with an upright bassist. He has a wife with an Etsy jewelry shop. So congratulations, Larry. You have filled the band dude bingo card. You're doing everything that a band dude, an ex-band dude, could be doing right now. But I think he basically plays in some sort of, it's not, I wouldn't say novelty. Like, the singer says that it's a joke band in a couple songs, but it's like some sort of country kind of like blues, you know, it's like Mumford and Sons type shit or something. That's what he's doing. I think he does drums. I'm not sure. Eric Marcelino, it's actually funny if you look him up on Facebook. I won't say what you get. You get one result if you look him up on Facebook, and it's not that bad, but it's a weird thing to be his only thing. But if you go to that profile, it's like 10 years out of date, and he used to do a dubstep DJ thing called E-Mars. Eric Marcelino, E-Mars. And so all of his stuff on that is about his DJ night called Throde, which had merch. But he's the only band member whose web footprint, like, loudly proclaims that he was in the Dedication. He says, like, he's a founding member of the Dedication and stuff like that. And his whole new thing is that he runs some kind of like luxury goods consignment shop, and his ad agency, I put in quotes, I think it's just an SEO company. It says it's an ad agency, but the whole website is just about SEO. So I think they wanted it to be else.
Mean, you put an entrepreneur, then that means probably SEO bullshit. So
yeah, and he's wearing a crazy outfit as the owner. So I think he's meant to be like the wacky, you know, wacky owner of this place. But it looks like a regular business. So I assume he's doing all right. That SEO company is probably doing all right for him. I don't think he plays music anymore that I can see. Rich Peruzzi. We'll do, I don't know which of these two guys to do first. I'll do Rich Peruzzi first. Rich Peruzzi is an extremely successful art and design person.
Oh, really? Wow.
I mean, it seems like it. You know, maybe because he works for the biggest companies on the planet. And maybe those are the kind of places where they hire art directors for like every single client. So you could be a schlub and work for one of these places. But he's the art director for he's been the art director for three of the largest advertising firms on the planet. And one of them includes TWBA Chiat Day, which was like my dream job when I was a young boy. You know, that ship has sailed for me, but he did it. And that's the company who, among other things, created the Taco Bell Chihuahua. So that's,
oh my God. That's, oh my God. Rich, you got to come on the show.
Yeah, Rich, he's got his he's got his hands and some things we need. And he's doing all right. He lives in Europe. I think he just moved to Germany or something like that. He was in Denmark, but he's still into hardcore. He's in a couple of different hardcore bands. He's in like a power punky pop band. He's in Hypocrite still. He's still out there. He wears hardcore shirts and all of his photos. It's because he's got a cool life, and he can still be into the stuff he likes. He doesn't have to, you know, shy away from it. He also runs a footy fan. Mike might enjoy. He runs an Instagram of bootleg Arsenal jerseys.
Oh, wow.
And I'm going to be very careful with my critiques when we get to the layout portion of the show today, because this guy outclasses me so enormously that it's a shame that I'm even talking right now. Sonny Kilfoyle runs a shooting dog training farm on Long Island and literally is leading some kind of Peaky Blinders life in real life. Like
what is shooting dog? What is that?
It is... like when you think of like a gentleman putting on a $300 sweater and a tweed shooting jacket and taking like a $14,000 rifle.
Oh, he's like the duck hunt dog. Like
yeah,
the duck hunt
dogs. Yes, he's training the duck hunt dog to bring back a pheasant. One pheasant. He takes six dogs out. That's this. And his whole feed is like hunting dogs and occasionally like red nose guys in scally caps drinking scotch by a fireplace. Like he is leading that life. And it seems to be going pretty well for him. He also may be just a little bit leaning toward the right since he's a gun guy. He posts about guns a lot. But you know, his guns are, you know, fancy two like double barreled shotguns with engraving on them. So maybe that's not so bad. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a lot better work than I did while I was taking the bus home and quickly scrawled some things down because I forgot to do that at work. Yeah, I forgot to say I did say these guys went on to do a couple of these guys went on to do Sex Positions. For those not in the know, Sex Positions also ended up being on Death Wish like a year later. Yeah. I really like the Sex Positions, but it was one of those things where them, like I guess these guys and also West from American Nightmare, I think all discovered the 3-1-G sound at the same time.
Yeah.
And Wes did Some Girls and these guys did Sex Positions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was also discovering that sound too. So, so I was like, oh, this is great. So I like looking back at it, I don't know if I would love that Sex Positions record as much as I did. Cause I definitely at one point liked that more than I liked the Dedication record. But, now that I'm more used to it, I haven't gone back to revisit it, but, so, I don't, you know, we'll get to it at the end. So I don't know if that was really a great evolution for them or what, but yeah, so at least a few of these guys were in two good bands that I liked a lot. So, but I don't think we really need to talk about Deathwish Records. It is one of the very few record labels I think we'll ever talk about that is not only successful, but it's also still going. Yep. And it's also, not only is it still going, but it's also still putting out heavy and aggressive music because, usually any record label that lasts this long, which is about 20 years now, a little over 20 years actually, at some point they're gonna veer off to the dark side of putting out singer-songwriter music and acoustic bullshit and stuff like that. But pretty much for the most part, I mean, they're leaning a little more heavy on the door guy metal and stuff like that now, but outside of that, like, they are still putting out heavy shit. It's still run by Jake Bannon. He's still in the heavy music scene. If you need any more information about Deathwish Records, there is a podcast. I think they're on a little break right now, but it's called Deathscography. Mm-hmm. And those dudes go over every single release of Deathwish Records in chronological order. So they probably covered this Dedication record a few years ago, but it's a pretty good podcast. Like I said, I think they're on hiatus right now, but I think they're up all the way up until like 2009 into the catalog. So if you want to listen to any in-depth doxing on any records from 2009 to 2001 from the Deathwish catalog, definitely go check out Deathscography. But yeah, I mean, Jake Bannon has put out a bunch of stuff. Oddly enough, Deathwish Records number 2 is A Boy Sets Fire. I did not know that. But yeah, they put out a lot of the Boston and Northeast stuff that wasn't the Bridge 9 stuff.
Yeah.
Damage, Horror Show, The Promise, Jesus Eater, Knives Out, Some Girls, all the classic early stuff, the I Hate You discography, which we've already talked about, Reach the Sky, A Life Once Lost. It goes on and on and on. They put out so much stuff. Right now, I think, I don't know, did they put out the record, the Converge with the Lady Singing? I don't know if
that's... Oh, you know, I
Blood think, Moon?
Yeah, is Blood Moon. Yeah. Yeah, that's Death Wish.
Yeah, that is like... Ugh, that is,
I kind of like it. I know, yeah. I know we're really under like no it. Compulsion to like that.
But yeah, I mean, they're still putting out stuff like that. They're putting out pretty much still hard bands, like not stuff I really listen to. And odd stuff, too. They re-released a Shelter record. Mm-hmm. They're still putting out Modern Life is War. There's a band called Bosk, which is I believe a Star Wars reference.
Yes.
So I'm going to assume they are some impossible to get into slow doom band that probably stinks. No, they're not.
No, they're pretty good. It's pretty like weird hardcore. It's pretty good.
Oh, I just saw the name.
I would guess that too.
The imagery, and I was like, I'm going to pass on this. I don't know. I think they kind of hit big with Touche Amore, kind of crossed over with that. But yeah. Jake has had his ear to the streets for a long, long time, and you can't really talk shit on Deathwish. They've put out a lot of great stuff.
Do you think it's him? I don't know anything about the business. Like, do you think it's run like a? Do you think it's taken on a life of its own and it's a whole business with like young tastemakers who kind of can pick these bands out? Or you think Jake Bannon sits there and says yes, no, yes, no, and sorts through the bands?
I mean, he's like, it seems like when he gets into stuff, he'll do the design work and stuff. That's true. I don't really keep up with it. I don't know how much he still does that, but I mean, he did it in the early days. Yeah, he might be a little more hands off. There's another guy, Trey, involved with this that might be a little more hands on. But I mean, I know they're like personable guys because that discography podcast, I asked them, like, have they ever like reached out to you or anything? And like, they're aware of the podcast. I don't know if they like promote every episode or something, but you know, they're not like, hey, this fucking sucks or anything like that.
Could you guys stop doing that?
Can you fucking stop doing this shit? Yeah, I don't think so. They put out, I think Frail Body is one of, I think the newest Deathwish band that I really like a lot. So, I don't know how much Jake is doing the shit, but, you know, either way, they haven't sold out to nonsense bullshit music yet, at least.
You know, when this label started, mm-hmm. I was still super into the C bands, all the C mm-hmm. bands. I had no idea that it was Jake Bannon, like for a long time. I just didn't, because I don't pay attention to labels that much. I don't really care. And I was kind of like in and out of caring about hardcore at the time. I had no idea that it wasn't until a few of our friends got very into the Amazing Core sound and were courting this label that I sort of realized what was going on. And, you know, it didn't work out for any of those guys, but it did work out for our friends end of the year since they got on Death Wish. And I think that kind of helped them out quite a bit. But I think it's cool how varied this is. Like, I think that Zola Jesus thing is not at all even hard. I think that's like some kind of weird Bjork singer, crazy singer.
I mean, it's not all aggressive music, but like I said, for the track records of most of these record labels by now, they're putting out bullshit. So we're at the 20-year mark, so they're really doing it.
I just expect everything on this label to be like Trap Them and Cult Leader, and it's kind of far. The fact that Boy Sets Fire is Deathwish number two is like they set the standard kind of.
So now we can get this record out into a tray. Nice. So this is a record layout that I'm gonna say I really loved at the time because it was kind of, I don't know, it was different. It was very different. Looking back at it, probably doesn't age well. Not like graphically or anything like or design wise. It's just so the whole deal with this quote unquote packaging or layout is that it comes in a plastic sleeve that's a little heavier than a normal plastic sleeve you would get a record in. This is kind of the plastic that you would put your work lanyard in on your little work necklace. It's kind of that thick, heavy plastic that's hard to fuck with. But inside the plastic is just a single sheet of, you know, semi thick paper. And the record, there's no dust sleeve or nothing like that. And that's like, I don't know what started it, but I know there's like as far as record collecting goes, there's like a new movement to not even put your records inside the sleeve anymore. You put the dust jacket, you put the record in the dust jacket and put the dust jacket outside of the cover. Mm-hmm. And you put it all in a plastic sleeve. I forget why. I don't care. Like, I have fucking 50-year-old records that have been in the sleeves forever. Yeah. They're still in mint condition. I don't know what the fuck. What am I preparing for the nuclear holocaust with my records? Like they're not gonna get any less. Like they're not gonna get any more shitty if they're like, I don't know. Like, I'm sure somebody will tell me why, but I just don't know. But either way, this doesn't have that luxury. This is just like, I'm sure. If you played this a lot, like I sold my original copy. I had a clear version, which was the first press. This is a red version, which is the second press. I'm sure if this was a record you played a lot and you took it out of the package a lot, it probably got really fucked up. So there's probably a lot of really fucked up copies of this record out there. So probably bad form. Secondly, it's probably like this would probably look really cool if you were on a budget. I don't know how back in 2002, I don't think Converge or Death Wish Records were a career. I'm sure those dudes still had like somewhat of day jobs and stuff like that. So maybe they were a little budget friendly, but or budget conscious, but it seems kind of crazy coming from Mr. Graphic Design himself, Jake Bannon, that he cut corners on a layout. But, you know, whatever. Like I said, 2002, I thought this was a really cool idea for a record because the whole deal is that I think all of the different color variants were transparent. So you put the cardstock, which is like a mix of PP yellow and cummy beige, and you put like a clear record against that, and it looks really cool. You can see pictures on our Instagram, obviously, if you don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But it looks really cool. The actual cover is, it says the dedication in just a pretty boring impact font. It has a drawing of a back of a person's head, and then a bunch of blood splatters. This is 2002, man. That blood splatter brush pack on Photoshop was hitting hard.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody had it. Everybody was using this. This is, I think I used this, I used this for Ipecac for the Soul, one of my first zines. I use the same brush pack. I get it. But again, super cool in 2002. You turn over that sheet and it's just the lyrics pretty much right out there. Again, in that same impact font, they are center formatted, which is probably a no-no, but I'm sure Scott will speak more on that. But yeah, it's pretty simple. It looks pretty cool outside of, 20 years later, record nerds probably flipping their lids about how unsafe this is for the actual vinyl. It looks pretty, I think I thought at the time, and I still think it's a pretty cool but sort of cheap kind of way to present a record, but it's different though, so I like it.
Yeah, that kind of plastic kind of forms into whatever it's touching, so I can imagine like eventually one side of your record isn't going to play anymore because it's going to be filled in with like leaching chemicals from that stuff. This layout's pretty whatever for me. I think it's cool that they went with the dried blood color instead of a blood color. But, you know, we had some friends who ran a whole t-shirt company with this brush pack, and I'm kind of worn out on it. But, yeah, like when I look at I've only seen the scans, but when I see this, I think of how interesting it is that this is basically just prior to the times when you could do anything and get anything. So, you know, like 10 years later, the Graf Orlock record that comes in a boombox came out. You know, you could just make all kinds of weird shit happen. And, you know, I sat around cutting up 5 1/4 floppy disks and spray painting them to make one of our CDs. You know, you would just do these weird ad hoc things because you couldn't do anything in 2001, 2002, even up to like 2004, 2005. You couldn't do any. Like nowadays, if you want to like do foil embossing on some sort of weird shape that folds out into a bird or whatever, or that you can eat like edible rice paper or something, you could do whatever you want. But this is like kind of a compromise. Like, what can I do at Staples that would be weird? I look at it now and it kind of looks like swag, like they put together some leftovers and put it in a record. But in 2002, I've been like, whoa, this won't even fit in my record box, man. This is fucking crazy. So, you know, not many points for the design, but lots of points for the MacGyver skill on making a unusual item from household bullshit they probably had lying around.
So, that's about it for that. I guess we can get into the music. So this is a 3-track record. So on the CD version, it has the track 1 and track 2 that are on the 7-inch on side A. And then there's 3 songs, and then side B is the 6th song on the CD. And it's kind of an odd sequence because the first 2 songs on side A are, you know, a couple minute songs, and then the side B song is 5 minutes long, and they could have easily probably fit 5 out of the 6 songs on 1 7-inch, but they were like, we got to have that long 5 minute song in the 7-inch. I don't know. I'm not in the band. I don't know what the reasoning was, but we are talking about the 3 songs on the 7-inch, which I forgot to mention it up top, you can find these on Spotify. This is Death Wish Records. You could probably find them everywhere. I'm kind of shocked, even though they don't really have much of an output, put that there isn't a discography yet. But maybe soon, maybe after this episode blows up and everybody hears it, there'll be a demand for a dedication discography. But right now, this is it. It's on Spotify. This first track is called Thanks for Last Night. Watch out, baby! We'll be right back. So this starts off pretty dark and moody. And like I said, this whole like Bridge Nine era was a lot of bands taking the kind of boring traditional youth crew sound and going in kind of different directions with it. Like I think American Nightmare was most successful by taking it and making it a little more passionate, a little more emotive, making the lyrics a little more personal. It wasn't just about being stabbed in the back and bullshit like that. A little more emo. It was a little more intense. And then, you know, there's bands doing like wacky versions of Youth Crew and like all this type of shit. People making harder, you know, this and that. A lot of getting into the more fashion sense, a lot of swoop haircuts and stuff like that. It was, and so, like I said, Dedication was kind of an outlier because they weren't really any type of traditional hardcore band. They were almost like a screamo band that, for whatever reason, like decided to pepper their music with a little Youth Crew hardcore for some reason. And it worked. It was really cool. So this song, like, it structurally, it sounds kind of like a screamo song. The vocalist isn't very dynamic, but he's really going for it. He's screaming his lungs out. It's not, you know, it's not like in a cool way, but he's doing it. He's fucking doing it. He doesn't sound like he's not that normal whippy screamo sound either. It's, he's just screaming the shit out of the words. The song like starts off with like a gang vocal part. Again, you're not going to get that in a normal screamo song. The production overall is a little dusty on this though, even on the Spotify version. It just sounds like you're still listening to an old record. I don't know if that was on purpose or what, but either way, like this kind of like dark and moody semi screamo with a little peppering of Youth Crew, the Youth Crew gallop. And then like with all the sing along parts is super sweet. This definitely super unique at the time. Super like slick. I wouldn't say slick production wise, but just like they pull it off. Like it's not jangly. It's not sloppy. They're like, they're really hitting everything really good. They have like a very easy to learn sing along at the end for a big like gang part in real life. I think this is like a perfect song for what they're going for. Probably my favorite song on I mean, even within all the six songs, I think this is my favorite song on the track. So definitely a good opener for me.
Yeah, I think this song starts off really good. I like the beginning. I like how busy it is. Like every stringed instrument is doing its own thing at almost all times on this. It's a big heroic pile of, which is kind of the, you know, like all the sort of epic hardcore bands of the time. But this is like, I think this is a little more interesting for some reason. It just has some nice layers. And the gang vocals right up front, it's like really exciting. So I was prepared. I was strapped in. I was ready for some, it had kind of a menacing rock and roll thing going on at the beginning. And then it just takes a detour. It just becomes New Jersey screamo. Like the whole middle part basically sounds like Merrill to me or something like that. But that's fine. I like Merrill. It's just a surprise after the beginning that it just gets so kind of unhinged and a little sloppy, a little loose with the drumming. And then like at some point I noticed that one guitar is always trying to soar into the clouds. I think he soars a little too high because he's always kind of playing those high notes and they start to stand out to you. That's all you hear after a while. I don't think it's bad. Like I can tell what they're going for. I think it's cool. I like the sinister strut at the beginning a little bit more than the kind of the screamo part in the middle, but this is, this is definitely like not, this isn't exactly like anything I've ever heard before.
Yeah.
I think it's a surprise. It's good. It's a good surprise.
So the second track is a song called Our Song. So this goes kind of goes right in from first track right into the second track. Unlike Hate, though, which I don't think you could separate these songs. I think you could separate these two Dedication songs and play them in different parts of the set. So good for you. You learned a way to combine two songs to connect and also to play separately. That is a skill within itself. Mm-hmm. The lyrics on this are a little bit teen angsty and dramatic. A lot of endless suffering type stuff. The horror of living, the pain of dying just over and over again, the horror of knowing all that I've done, It's like I said, this is a little more emo screamo. So, but even for emo screamo, it's a little bare bones kind of teen angsty. But whatever, they were young, so whatever. This one's a little harder to pinpoint than the first one, that's for sure. It's kind of it almost kind of sounds like a Filter or a Bush song, like as not in a bad way. It's kind of like they took a like an alt rock song, like what would be considered a dark alt rock song, and made it a darker hardcore song. And like Scott said about the one guitars going like all over the place, that's kind of even more prevalent here. And I think that's what reminds me of something like Filter or Bush or something like that. Yeah. But I still like it, even though I compared it to two bands that I think are dog shit. But no, it's cooler. It's a little harder to describe, a little harder to put in a box. But it's still, like, I think it fits with their overall sound. I think if you put this with all six songs, I don't think this would be the top half. I think this was a bad choice. But again, I don't know why they chose the sequencing. So you know, you got to do what you got to do. But you know, it's still overall a decent song.
I like that this is connected to the other song. I think they connect well. I think this sounds like a big like transition for the other song, because it fits. It's kind of almost in a similar key. It just sounds like another part to that song, but it's totally different, and it's good and it's exciting. It has almost the exact same structure, where the beginning is this big, powerful like spectacle, and then just switches to kind of like fast punky screamo halfway through the track. But I love how like raw and untrained this vocalist is, that he is just like, you know, like some office guy who showed up and was upset about his day and just starts going, you know, I would be interested to hear what this would sound like with slightly better vocals, but you know, it's like, you can't really complain about this too much. If this is the same guy in the Sex Position album, he gets better by then. He's still doing the same thing. He's doing the same exact thing, but he's doing it way better. And Sex Positions is a couple years pre-YouTube, so I don't know how he improved. I don't remember how anyone improved before YouTube. How did he learn to scream better? But yes, still good.
Okay, so side B is the one track. It's called This Poison. So this is where, like I was saying, it was the odd go with the song, odd to the sequencing, because this is kind of like when a movie is released and the director's like, oh, it was originally 2.5 hours long, and we cut out an hour of it or whatever, and you're not getting my full vision. That's kind of what this is like. Like, I don't think this long song works if you don't hear those other three songs in the middle, because like I was saying, this is kind of screamo. But structurally, this song included in those other couple songs, these are structurally like almost metalcore. They never play metal, but there's it's like almost like a Poison the Well song, just played like almost straight. It's pretty cool. Like the record, the songs that were left off of this record kind of go more into that more in depth. A lot of those songs, including this one, the drummer gets to go off more, especially the ones that are left off. The drummer is very busy just hitting the craziest fills for otherwise non-metal music. Like, so it's a lot of metal drumming going on. It's musical. It's very musical compared to the other stuff. And you know, like I said, more metalcore. Eventually wanders back into a more standard hardcore groove though, and it gets into the sing, like the parts you're supposed to sing along to and stuff like that. At the end, one of the lyrics is, "That's why I wrote this fucking song." And that's like, I think that was a big trope back then, to acknowledge that you were writing a song about somebody or something. It was a very, very big American Nightmare trope. So I was glad to, that really piqued the nostalgia for me. You know, this long song that, you know, honestly doesn't need to be this long. There's nothing they were doing in the song that really needed to be this long. Not that it was bad, but they could have trimmed a fat little. But then it rings out, and then you hear somebody say, "All right, we're rolling," and then it goes in a piano, a very unneeded piano part. But they needed to have that piano part there for some reason. I respect their vision. Like I said, I think I would have rather, if it was my band, I would have probably put the two or three other tracks on this and left this long song on, but this must have meant a lot to them. This was the impetus for them breaking up, or half the band wanted the other songs, but I don't know. But, you know, it was crazier times back then. I think back then it was easy to be like, hey, if you want more, just buy the fucking CD. So it's probably a moot point, but, great. It was a good, overall, I like the 7-inch a lot. I think I would have just picked a couple different songs to be on it.
This song is some real Emerson, Lake, and Palmer shit, because they used up every version of the riff that they could think of at the end, because it's like the whole second half of the song is just variations on that chord progression or whatever. I looked over at my MP3 player at, like, you know, probably second or third variation, and I was like, oh, there's still 2 minutes left on this. Where are they going to go with this? And that... the little piano thing at the end is like, it's a lot like the Faith No More epic piano, where it's kind of like it's still playing the riff that the band was playing, except that they recorded it on a Victrola or something like that. So it's like shitty and stuff. But yeah, that would be funny if that was a tension point. But like, you had to push for that fucking piano, man. I told you. The beginning of this, I grew up with a really bad record player, a really broken, shitty record player. So my mental image of listening to Econochrist sounds exactly like the beginning of this song, where it's really thin and kind of clanky like that. That was strange. But the name of this band is so strange to me after listening to this whole record, because the dedication, I'm expecting some kind of like self-affirmation, maybe ironic, you know, maybe ironic positivity, or like the band that writes the love songs to the Straight Edge, you know, like something like some sort of like chest pounding, you know, like this is our truth shit or something. But this is three songs of absolutely first draft self-pity and misanthropy. Like, all these lyrics are just like, I hate you and I hate myself and you suck and I wish you were dead and I wish I was dead. But, and it's all screamed over like the Crown Hate Ruin or Engine Kid type rock or something like that, which is, it's just so strange. Not the reformed doom metal Engine Kid, the old wimpy Engine Kid. But the song opens with a finale and then gives you about six more finales. So this is a lot of finales. It's a lot of fucking finales. Maybe a few too many, but it's, you know, I would wonder, I didn't realize this was an EP. I kind of want to hear if the tone shifts at all for three whole songs that we didn't get to hear, that sort of earns this fireworks display at the end here.
I mean, I guess I didn't think about that. I guess it was like, this is our finale song. I guess we have to put it as a finale on our 7-inch. Yeah, so. Right. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Overall, this is, so as I was saying in the beginning, I really like this exposition. So when I was living in this moment and I was like, oh, the dedication of the new man, the Sexpositions, and I heard them, I was like, oh, you know, this is much better. Like, I like this a lot. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it was also when I was finding out about 3-1-G and Swing Kids and all that stuff too. So, looking back as, you know, a musical genius that I am now, and I know all this stuff in past tense. I think I like this dedication record isn't perfect, but I think if they didn't break up and they got to do another LP, it might have been like, I really like the spirit to this. I'm not young anymore, so I can't really get into the angst, but I appreciate it. I appreciate the rawness of the angst on this. You know, it might be a little, using a big word, $5 word, might be a little maudlin now, but it's you know, it's like, I like it. Like, people like old hardcore that's basically like little kid feelings too, so I'm allowed to like bands with little kid feelings, so I think this is pretty cool. It kind of bummed me out thinking, like, you know, I could just go listen to Swing Kids or something. I don't really need to listen to Sexpositions. It was probably a cool thing to do at the time in the era, but I think I would be selfish and would want a whole like dedication LP to see what they did after this, if they didn't discover 3-1-G, if they just kept on this path of this kind of like really angsty, half screamo, half Youth Crew, half Filter music. Like, I mean, who knows what they could have done with an LP? But so overall, my rating system is either throw it in the trash, listen to it on streaming, buy it on the clearance rack, buy it for full price, or buy it for collector's prices, and I judge the whole package, including you know, the music itself, the layout, the possibility for financial gain and stuff like that. I was kind of shocked to find out that this record pretty much averages, you know, a couple bucks. It's not going to set you back. I think maybe they probably just pressed a whole shitload of them. I mean, this is a second pressing. That means there was over 1,000 of them. But still, I think it's just, this is a band that got lost in the sauce. I just think there's so much music that came out around the same time that had a little more longevity to it. And I think they've even overshadowed themselves with Sex Position, so a lot of people forget about Dedication. It's hard for me to say collector's prizes just because there's so many out there that people already don't want. So I'm going to go definite full price, and you're not even going to have to pay full price for this. This is something that's going to be a buck or two for probably at least a few years until some entrepreneur, maybe the entrepreneur in the band, puts out a discography. It's only going to be a couple bucks. I think for a couple bucks, I think it's a steal for that. This is between full price and collector's prizes for me. I think this is a must own if you were a part of that time and you want something completely unique from, you know, their peers that they were playing shows with every day.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, that they leaned a little bit harder on kind of like an alt rock sound, and Sex Positions is this band without the Kilfoyles, who went on to form a band who kind of sounds like the Stone Roses or something like that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it. They just lost the guys who wanted to be, who wanted to be doing In Spiral Carpets. Those guys went off and did their own thing, and the hard men remained.
Yeah.
The first listen to this record was different for me than the others. The first one was like really promising, that's not leading to a bad outcome. It's just that the first one was really, I was like, oh yeah, this is like, I like all these layers. I like the pig pile of vocals that happens once in a while. I like all the ambition. It reminds me a lot of things, but doesn't sound exactly like anything. You know, it's like wimpy, but tough. It's like sloppy, but pretty. You know, it's like, it's a lot of stuff. It's a car crash. I kind of dug it. But the second time I listened to it, like maudlin is kind of a good word, because it had almost like this sound at the center of it that was like pushing against my ears in a bad way, like tinnitus or something, you know, cause it feels like it has one tone. Like, this kind of like one tone going through the whole thing. The screechy guitars I mentioned, the always intense vocals, like he never does anything other than that kind of messy intensity. And the production just feels like a column of air pushing into my ear, especially the ending song, which is just a tornado of big finishes. It's just finale after finale after finale. It really wears you after a while. I think a lot of their ideas got better in Sex Positions. Like they just added more to it, because they still do some of this stuff, but they break it up with like haunted house rock and like old just power chords and stuff here and there. And you could toss out all the electronic shit. That's who cares about all the noise. But I think that they added things to it that to appeal more to me. But this is good. This is cool. It's different. I think it's like a rough proof of concept. Like this is what led to the more fully realized thing. So that's like Mad Max versus Road Warrior. Like this is Mad Max, Sex Positions, Road Warrior. So I'm giving this 4 Lord Humongi out of 5. That's really good.
Yeah.
4 humongouses.
So there you go. This was one I was like, maybe Scott's going to hate this. So I'm glad that you pulled through and liked it. That's pretty much it. I don't know. I haven't really planned next week. I just figured after episode 50 would be too famous to even have to do this anymore. So.
No one talks to me, so we might be famous. We might have hit.
We might be too famous for episode 52. We'll see. But
yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, you know, let us know if you have any suggestions. If you even liked episode 50, maybe you hate it. I saw a lot of older folks that listen and were like, this fucking music is horrible. I thought I liked hardcore, but they were hating on it even more than we did. So
yeah,
that you know, I brought a tear to my eye. I was like, yes. I was like, there are more haters out there. We are not the only haters. So. That was a breath of fresh air to know that the other olds are haters too, and it's not all fucking roses and shit like that. So, until next time, you could reach us at First 7-Inch Club on our Instagram. There's a link tree there. First7inchclub@gmail, First7inchclub on YouTube, First7inchclub everywhere. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell everybody you know. Until then, fuck Charlie Daniels.
This is going to go on detour, but you gave me an idea. When you said earlier how like a lot of these bands would acknowledge the song within the song.
Yeah.
A small passion of mine is bands who talk about being on stage as though it's like an adventure.
Yes.
Like when I listen to the Scorpions, like, you know, I'm due on stage now. The wolf is after me and stuff like that. Like he's fighting with a sword, but also he's got to get on stage. I want to do a whole episode about cock rock bands who present the stage as a part. So if you want to hear us
it's literally every band.
I want to do every song where they're in a fantasy setting, but they are due on stage in the lyrics.